This is part two of a three-part interview with Lieutenant Commander John C. Inch, U.S. Navy. This interview is being conducted at the Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, on 26 March 1974. The interviewer is Captain R.A. Bowling, United States Navy retired, graduate student at the San Diego State University.
All right, Commander Inch, if you would, please, could you continue on from the other side?
Okay, well, we talked about the 23rd of May and my MIG kills. It was about 3 months later, 4 months, let's see, June, well, yeah, 3 months later, I was on another mission. I was shot down over North Vietnam. It was, again, the same type of mission that I was on before, a MIGCAP mission, protecting a strike group going into North Vietnam. And it was, our station was just south of the harbor of Haiphong, about 40 miles south of that, and about 19, 20 miles inland over a very populated rice paddy area. We had just gotten on station when we were taken under fire by several SAM batteries in the area. And my pilot, Lieutenant Commander Mike Doyle, and I, we started maneuvering. He started maneuvering the aircraft, and I was calling out the location of the SAMs being fired at us. And we were in the process of maneuvering against a SAM from one sector when one from another sector, which we didn't see, exploded over our aircraft. It was, of course, the best of my impression was seemed like it went off right over the cockpit. And I received, the reason I say that too is that I received several, quite a bit of shrapnel throughout my body, upper arms, chest, groin area, and upper legs, plus one fragment partially severed the thumb on my left hand, left it dangling. I immediately screamed out that we had been hit and called up in front to Mike to see if he was okay, and I got no response from him. And I looked up into the front cockpit, and Mike didn't look like he was sitting upright in a normal position, so I assumed that he must have received much more of a blast than what I did. And we were going about 500 knots and starting down about 3,000 feet. I realized that the airplane wasn't going to fly, so I initiated a command ejection. In the F4, there's a system in which either the pilot or the backseater can eject the other one. And I went to that mode and ejected one-handed from my seat. And the next thing I remember was the explosion of the seat going out. I was hanging in the chute. I looked around and I didn't see Mike's chute at the time. I found out later since I was returned that two chutes were sighted, so that I know that we did get him out of the aircraft. But he never showed up anymore, and never showed up in camp, and he is still listed as an MIA. But there I was hanging in the chute, and I remember trying to reach for my radio, which I carried on my, carried two survival radios, one on either side of my waist on a web belt and some holster type affairs. And as I reached for it with my right hand, I realized that my hand wasn't going where it was supposed to. I looked down and I realized and I saw that both elbows had been dislocated and pushed about halfway up the inside of each arm. So I had no use of my arms. And my thumb was still bleeding pretty badly and dangling. I didn't have much more time to do much else there. I was pretty close to the ground by this time, since we did eject at a very low altitude and a high speed. And I looked down and saw I was about ready to land in a rice paddy, so I just tried to relax and land and not do any more damage to myself, broken leg or anything. Landed in a rice paddy, and after I fought my head back above the water, I laid my head up on a little embankment, little walkways that they have through the rice paddies. And at that time was when I realized that I was being fired upon by rifles from the ground. The people on the ground were shooting at me, and the bullets were landing 3 or 4 feet from my head, making the water spurt up. And so I could do nothing but lay there. I had no use of my arms, and I was still in my chute, couldn't get out of it. So I just laid there and just prayed like hell that they wouldn't shoot me, because I couldn't stand up and give myself up. But they stopped shooting after a few seconds, and then I heard them coming up through the water after me. And when they finally got within sight of me, they saw that I was no threat, I guess. They came up and started stripping me of all my equipment, cut my chute off of me, cut my flight suit, harness, other things off of me, with very little regard for my wounds. They just kind of jerked and pulled and tugged at my arms. First thing they went for was my wristwatch, which was on my left hand. I recall the guy had to push my thumb out of the way in order to get to the clasp to get it off. But after that, they stripped me down to my shorts and t-shirt and threw me into a fishnet with a pole through it, and carried me over to a village about 300-400 yards away and stuck me inside a little hooch. That it was about 6:30 in the evening when I was shot down, so it was getting, wasn't but another hour and a half or so till dark. I was kept there until dark. While I was there, a lady came by with a little sort of a first aid kit, and she took out some gauze and wrapped my injured thumb into the palm of my hand, just tied it in place so it wouldn't be flopping around. And that was about the extent of the medical attention I got for the next 3 days. After dark, they picked me up, carried me down through some paths and out to a main road, oh, I'd say a mile, maybe a mile and a half away. And there was a truck waiting there for me, and they threw me in this truck. And there were about three or four guards in the truck. It's a pickup type truck with a canvas over the back. And they started driving, and they took me to Hanoi.
What was your shoot-down date, Commander?
It was the 25th of August, 1972. And on the way into, on the way, I ended up at the what we call the Hanoi Hilton Hua Lo prison in Hanoi. We made one stop. We made two stops on the way. From the time they picked me up from the village until I got into Hanoi Hilton. The first stop was after about an hour's drive, I guess, and I was blindfolded, made to lie down in the back of this truck, and was covered up with a piece of tarpaulin or something. And I remember I was trying to keep my mind alert enough to make notes of things that were going on around me at this time. And I remember hearing an awful lot of truck traffic on the roads going in the opposite direction, so going south, since I was going north toward Hanoi. So there was a lot of truck traffic, I remember that. The first stop, they took me out of the truck and set me in a small room in a town. It was not a little village, but a town. We had, buildings of several stories. They took me into this one building, set me down in a room about the size of this one here, 12 by 14, something like that maybe. And there was a desk in there, and I was made to sit on a small stool in front of the desk. And Vietnamese in a white shirt came in and sat down behind the desk. And a photographer came in, started snapping pictures of me sitting on the desk in my short, or the stool in my shorts and shirt. And I just turned my head away from him as he was trying to take pictures. Not trying to be belligerent, but just trying to be uncooperative in a passive way. And then the guy behind the desk who spoke English told me that wanted to know my name, where I was from, and a lot of other questions that I told him I couldn't answer because I was only allowed to give him four things: name, rank, service number, date of birth. And then he started berating me about being a war criminal and everything. And the thing I really remember about it was he told me that Miss Jane Fonda had just been in his town and not too long ago, and she had seen the true story and what had been done. And I guess apparently trying to impress me with the fact that Miss Fonda was more or less in sympathy with their cause. And he didn't really try to persuade me or sway me, I think, but it was just, my impression was that it was just a way for them to brag a little bit, you know, that Miss Fonda had been here and she, you know, she was an American and was on their side, I guess.
How did that make you feel at the time?
My condition was such that I was, you know, injured, and I'm sure I was in shock of some kind, but I thought it was a pretty goddamn poor comment on the American, of her as an American, to give aid and comfort to the enemy, an enemy or a country that we were in a conflict with. It made me feel, you know, like, well, oh, I felt bad to think that a fellow American would do something like that, but I have no respect for Ms. Fonda whatsoever, and so I don't want to get into a personality conflict here, because in my estimation, I have a personality and Ms. Fonda doesn't, so that would be a conflict, I think. I just think that she was completely wrong in being over there in the first place. I don't think she knows what the hell's going on in the first place, and even if she didn't agree with the war, I think she should say it over here in this country and not in the country in which we're in combat with. And she was kind of demoralizing to a lot of the POWs. And she and Mr. Ramsey Clark, who I was even more disappointed in, to think that a man who had held such a high position in our government would go over there and give aid and comfort to the enemy, as I call it, and be brainwashed by them practically and into making some of the statements. I think it's inappropriate for any American citizen to go into a country like that. We had Tokyo Rose and some of these in Second World War who were later jailed or executed, I think, for the very damn same thing. And in the Vietnam War, they're practically national heroes. I think it's a damn poor comment on the American society today.
Just one thing, Commander, if you would, this the term you used, aid and comfort to the enemy. Could you give some specific examples, please?
Well, I said aid and comfort to the enemy, and the fact that I think they aided the enemy in prolonging the war, and they gave the enemy, I think, because of their the Sloan Kaufmans and the Ramsey Clarks and Fondas and all of them going over there, and this constant stream of Americans over there, I feel gave the Vietnamese the idea that this is the way the American people felt. And I think it prolonged the war. I think that had if they had realized earlier exactly how strongly the American people felt, the majority of the American people, I mean, about the war and about getting the POWs back, I don't think that the war would have lasted that long. I think that those people that went over there aided the enemy in their propaganda cause and gave comfort to them in the fact that they thought that they were swaying the thinking here in the United States, which it was that small handful of people over there giving them all this propaganda, which they used, I think, against the POWs, in my case there, and in some of the other POWs, I can't speak from personal experience, but we're constantly told about the people coming through there, and some of them forced to meet these peace groups against their will.
Did you ever meet any of them?
No, I never did. And that's, I'm quite proud of that, because I'm...
Were you ever pressured to meet with them?
No, not during the period of time that I was there. I never was pressured to. For one thing, I don't think I ever would have been because of my injury. I don't think that they would have wanted me to meet the people because I was... They put forth only the best looking and the most healthy POWs to meet these type of groups. They didn't want to have a man whose thumb they had chopped off meet one of these groups. And I might get into that a little later here as exactly how they operated on me.
Yes, let's get back into that, and then we can come back to the other part of it.
Well, after this stop, we made another stop, which was at the river, waiting for a ferry to take us across to Hanoi. And I ended up in the Hanoi Hilton late that night or early the next morning. Anyway, at dark. And I was put into a room about 12 feet square and was just laying on the floor there. And that started the 3 days of interrogation, around-the-clock interrogation. Again, I was received no medical attention. My arms were starting to turn black from lack of circulation. My thumb was, again, just wrapped up into the palm of my hand. And they interrogated me, asking me past the name, rank, and serial number business. They wanted to know strike forces. They wanted to know military information about the ship, the air wing I was from, about the airplanes, what type of missions we flew, what altitudes, what airspeeds, names of commanding officers of various squadrons, just all kinds of military information is completely against the Geneva Convention. And I informed them, and I couldn't tell them, that I was bound by the Code of Conduct and the Geneva Convention to give only the Big Four. And they informed me that unless I wanted medical attention, I would have to start answering questions. And that they said I was not cooperating, that I had a bad attitude, and that they would not give me medical attention until I answered the questions. So this went on for 3 days. And as I said, they started telling me, you know, you are dying. You're just laying there dying, and as long as you refuse to answer our questions, we can't do anything about it. So after about 3 days of this, I guess I was, and at least I really started believing that I was dying. And I had this conflict in my own mind as to whether I should, what I should do. Was I doing any good to lay there and die? Or would it be better to try to make up a story and half-truths, lies, and whatever, and see if I could get some medical attention? And so I decided to go the route that I would. Some of the information they already knew. They had caught me, and they asked me what ship I was from, and I told them that I didn't know, or that I was from a ship that had already departed the area or something. they came right back and told me what ship I was from, so they already knew that. So I realized that they knew more than what I was giving them credit for. So I decided that I'd go ahead and answer questions, since it was 3 days since I had been, I had no more valuable information about current strikes coming in. I could do no more harm to my fellow aviators, I didn't figure.
It would have to be 6 days now, wouldn't it?
No, this was, no, 3 days. I arrived up in Hanoi the same night as shot down, and I lay for 3.5 days after that. So I started answering questions with the idea behind it that I'd make up a story that I could easily remember in case I was ever questioned again. I could readily recall these things so they wouldn't catch me in a lie. I gave them information that I figured they could get out of any Aviation Newsweek or a Time magazine or Stars and Stripes, and they have all those publications up there. And so I decided that, well, the best thing to do is construct a story and see if what happens. So I started giving them, for names of people, I gave them names of people from my past who I knew would never appear there, and but yet they were familiar enough with me, to me, that I could recall them at a moment's notice. So I stuck these names into the squadron skipper's names that they asked for, and the other things I answered, like I said, just what I figured they could already have, they already knew, or else they could easily get from a unclassified publication. And it seemed to satisfy them. So then that night, the third night, they came in well after dark. I guess must have been 9, 10, 11 o'clock, something like that. Took me out, put me in a truck again, covered me up, and drove me to a small hospital there in Hanoi. And took me into this room and strapped me down to a table. Held my arm, my shoulders and head, strapped me across the feet, the thighs and the upper body, chest, with leather straps to the table. And then held me, my arms, and they started cutting on my thumb. And I, of course, screamed in pain, and I said, please, wait, give me some anesthetics, some kind, put me to sleep or do something. And the response was that, no, there's no need for that, because you have not fully cooperated with us. And besides, you have caused suffering in our country, and now it is time for you to experience suffering. That is just as well as I can remember, just about what they told me. And in so many words, that was what it was. So they proceeded to cut my thumb off without anesthetic. And it's an experience I will probably never forget. After that, they wrapped it up, set me up on the table, and then set my elbows, again without anesthetic, just holding me in place and pulling until they heard them pop back in. They put them in some kind of a wire cast, both elbows, put me back in a truck, took me back to the Hanoi Hilton, back into the same room, and I laid there for another 2 or 3 days until, again at night, they took me out and put me into a small bamboo hut in the middle of a large courtyard, which turned out to be the what we called Camp Unity. It's where the other POWs in the camp were being held. And I was kept there in solitary for 23 days, and then I was put in with the other prisoners.
Did you get in with the other prisoners then at that time?
After that 23 days of solitary, during which time I made contact with them, I poked a few holes in the bamboo matting and made contact with some of the prisoners that were in the other little courtyards and other cells. And we were caught communicating at one point. And it was immediately after that that I was put in with the others.
How were you communicating?
Well, we communicated with sign language and mostly sign language, because I was separated from the rest of them by such a distance that I couldn't really use the tap code or anything. Also, there were some Vietnamese and Thai prisoners that were in the camp with us, and they more or less were used as slaves and worked around the camp and cleaned it up and swept it. And they made contact with me, voice contact, and I was able to get a note, a written note, out to some of the other senior officers in the camp through these Thai prisoners. And so those were the methods I communicated, got my name out to the other POWs.
On this TAP code, Commander, is that the regular Morse code?
No, it's a... you just set up a grid, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then it'd be A, B, C, D, E. You go across like that. So a tap of 1, 1 would be A, 1, 2 would be B, and it's continued on like that. It's a series. The first tap indicates a column vertically, and the second tap indicates the column horizontally, and you just know what that is. You just kind of memorize it. And the guys that use it for years and years, they got quite proficient at it. They carry on quite a conversation of that thing. The other one is a flash code, which was a variation of the deaf and dumb hand. You spell each letter out, you know, A, B, C, D. Each position of the hand indicates a certain letter, and you just spell out each word as you go. And that was our flash code.
You got pretty fast at it, what you just did.
Well, just not as well as some of them did. They some guys could talk almost as fast as I'm conversing right now. But after, let's say, that was during that 23 days, they pulled me out several times and tried to get me to sign statements and write letters to the president and letters to congressmen and senators and condemning the war and saying that I was against the war and this type of thing. And I steadfastly refused, and luckily they didn't put any more pressure on me. I say luckily because I certainly didn't want to undergo any more torture than what I already had. But they, luckily, at the time I was shot down, the heavy torture and everything was a thing of the past. So
there had you had information that there had been excessive torture in the past.
Yes. Up to the point where they actually killed men under torture. Some of the POWs that were there, the old timers, some of their roommates didn't come back because they were actually tortured to death. So I know Miss Fonda wouldn't agree with that point, but I can tell you for a fact that it happened. And I know from a first hand, I can tell you, as I just did, how they, quote, operated on me and the type of treatment they gave me in 1972. So.
Okay, for possible cross-reference, could you give for the record the names of any POWs whom you thought were, or you just heard, hearsay is good enough, but for reference, who might have been tortured to death, and if so, the names of anybody who are still alive who might have first-hand information of that torture?
Well, one of them was Ed Atterbury, was... He was involved in an escape attempt with Colonel John Dermisi, and he never showed up again. Another one was an Earl Cobell.
Was he recaptured? Or was
yes,
he
both of them. Both of them were recaptured, brought back into the camp,
and just
severely beaten, and Atterbury never showed up again. Colonel Dermisi was returned with us, and I'm sure he would have more about that than I do. And that another one was that I heard about was an Earl Cobell, who was I was told was beaten to death.
The Navy, Air Force?
I don't recall right offhand now. But I think most any of the older POWs, and I don't mean old, but I mean the ones that were kept there for a longer period of times, would have much more information on this story than what I have here. But John Dermisi, I think, could probably tell you more about Ed Atterbury than anybody since they were together.